You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hi, everyone. Good evening, and welcome to the winter-spring season of Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs and Strategic Partnerships at the Library Foundation. Before we begin tonight's program, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognizes and acknowledges the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend the respect to all Indigenous peoples today. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in the support of the Los Angeles Public Library. And thank you to the Library Foundation supporters and members who are here this evening. If you are not yet a member, I hope that you will consider joining the foundation to see more programs like this one and to increase critical access to information, resources, and technology to help Angelenos improve their lives and to fill their dreams throughout the city. And I don't know where it is, but there is a QR code. There you go. And you can just join if you'd like. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Estate of Suzanne E. Aron, Errant Fox Shift, the Hearst Foundations, Golden Globe Foundation, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Sharon Oxborough, Ralph M. Parsons, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, the Gregory Peck Library Foundation, Literary Foundation, and of course, individual donors and members. Aloud is expanding its footprint and scope. We are adding to our already popular author series that you're here for tonight with three additional branches, so to speak. Aloud on Ideas, a thematic series that looks deeply at subjects in the zeitgeist. This fall, we'll be doing a three-part series on AI. Aloud in Review, which will focus on a book or theme, but will approach it in unconventional format, meaning more cabaret than conversation. Our first review is next Tuesday at 7:30. It's entitled Rage, She Wrote, with a group of fascinating, renowned women writers and performers who will delve into the topic of female rage. And finally, Aloud in Community, a series we will co-produce with chosen branches each season by helping to facilitate and support several programs. One more note, tickets to Amor Tolls are on sale on our website. For more information about Aloud programs, visit lfla.org. And now, tonight's program. I'm excited to introduce these two profound, intelligent women whose work is frequently described as unconventional and experimental. Sheila Hetty's new memoir, Alphabetical Diaries, is taken from a diary she wrote over a 10-year period. Sorry, I have my notes. Where she recorded her thoughts simply but with great precision. Its density makes you pause. You read the sentence a few lines again and again. Lines like, quote, "Just because things are hard, that doesn't mean you made the wrong decision." Or, quote, "Marriage is one step closer to divorce than being in a relationship." Hetty kept a record of her thoughts, then arranged the sentences from A to Z. Who would have thought that this simple but unconventional arrangement for a memoir would create such an engaging book? Dwight Gardner's review in the New York Times captures Hetty's magic. Quote, "No one at this point in history knows how to live, so we read biographies and memoirs, hoping to get some clues," Sheila Hetty writes in Alphabetical Diaries. Her powerful and intimate new book, that is why we read novels too, of course, for the clues. Hetty knows this. This is a conceit that would expose a lesser writer. He or she would be left naked artistically once the narrative tide had gone out. Hetty's voice, on the other hand, is rendered clearer and more electric. A switch has been flipped. She's not in stereo. Suddenly, she's in mono. The effect is riveting. Every notion is packed tight. The reader stands amid a landslide of verbiage that more resembles poetry. Sheila Hetty is the author of 11 books, including the novels Pure Color, Motherhood, and How Should a Person Be, which New York Magazine deemed one of the new classics of the 21st century. She was named one of the new vanguard by the New York Times book critics. Her work has been translated in 24 languages. Michelle T. is the author most recently of Knocking Myself Up, a memoir of my infertility. She is a creator of Drag Queen Story Hour, a recipient of awards from PEN America and the Guggenheim Foundation, and the publisher of Dopamine Books. Please welcome Sheila Hedy and Michelle T. Thank you.
Hi.
Oh, also hi.
I'm going to start with a little reading from the book, and I would just like somebody to volunteer a letter. Jay? Okay. This is actually a short chapter, so I'll read the whole chapter. It's just 2.5 pages. Jack said he would be happy to live in Toronto if he thought he could find a man here, but there are no men in the city, so he had to come to Berlin. Jack tried to pick up the man who left on the bicycle. Jack wandered over to the low stone wall by the river and lay there for a while. Jack was a rock star because he liked all of it, playing music, the reaction of the crowd, being up there performing. Jack was lying on the floor, too drunk to be sitting up. Jack was making out with 3 men. Jack was photographing himself with his computer in black and white, moving his hand gradually across his face in animation. Jack's certainty that he will write more songs. Joseph and I got a room together, and we went into the bathtub to wash our feet. Joseph and I went into the woods. Joseph and I were supposed to swim together tonight, but I think neither of us wanted to. After a day in a car together, you'd rather be alone. Joseph and Jack are looking out the windows of the tour bus. Joseph bought Jack some falafel. Joseph is asleep on the sleeper with his beautiful brown hair all over his face. Joseph lay down at one point during the show and was covered in sweat, and I had a desire to lick him. Joseph only reads Steppenwolf. Joseph picked up a man on the street in Madrid, and they spent 20 minutes in the basement of that man's apartment getting it on. Joseph said he doesn't want to sing Jack's fucking music in the tour van because that only validates it. Joseph said he prefers the smaller shows because he can go and do merch after and meet the crowd. He does not like the big stadium shows because there you cannot. Joseph said he was shitting blood for 3 days after Jack fucked him without lube and without a condom the first time they met and had sex. Joseph said, in your position, I wouldn't have come. Joseph says, it's funny that Jack says he's looking for love when he's one of the least loving people I know. Joseph wanted to explore Barcelona, but we were too drunk on gin and tonics. Joseph was saying that he was deeply ambivalent about his relationship with his boyfriend because he doesn't think he would choose this man as his friend, and he thought it would be much nicer to have a boyfriend he could have an intellectual connection with, someone with opinions, who wasn't, as he put it, so much a part of the herd. Just as some ideas must be accepted many times, other ideas must be rejected many times. Just be quiet and retain your dignity and think about how everyone has their own image of goodness and you have to remain close to yours or else your life will be a complete blur, mud, a mess, a mistake. Just because he has the courage to ruin his life and sell his soul doesn't mean I must do that too. Just because there are difficulties, that doesn't mean you have done anything wrong. Just because things are hard, that doesn't mean you have made the wrong decision. Just deprive that part of your brain, deprive it of oxygen and let it die. Just don't think about it. Just kidding. Thanks.
Yes, clap. I love this book so much. I felt like it was a very noble undertaking. Like I could feel the nobility of like, you know, I mean, it's you, it's your diary, but it's like the narrator, you know, the character that you become as you're talking about your life. I just loved all the things that she was doing and thinking about. And there's such a connection, obviously, even though it's your diary, between it and your other books too. But I wanna know, like, what is your relationship with having a diary? Like, have you always had one?
My first diary was a Ramona Quimby diary. It was like a fill in the blank. You know, I like so-and-so because she is, you know, that kind of diary, or when I grow up, I want to be this. And I really loved that diary. And I think I had, like, no diary experiences till I was much older, apart from that Ramona Quimby diary. And then around the time like that I was, like, in my 20s, I guess, I started writing my diaries. And I realized that I could keep a diary if I wrote them on the computer, because I think writing them in on paper by hand was just too much of a barrier, whereas I'm always on the computer and I love writing on a computer. So that I started thinking, okay, I can write my diary on the computer. It doesn't have to be some like weird, ancient, private.
Right, like with a lock and a feather.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be so like childlike or something. And then, yeah, so I just write in a diary, or I have written in a diary whenever I feel like it, which might be like twice a month. You know, it's not very regular.
Do you don't feel like you have to, like, oh, so much has happened since the last time I was with you, diary. I have to catch you up. Do you feel like that? Like, do you feel like your diary is a living thing?
Or... No.
Okay.
It's like, if I can't call Catherine Burrell because it's like, whatever, she's asleep, then I go to my diary. Like, there's certain friends that I, like, like working out problems with. Mm-hmm. And if they're asleep, then I go to my diary.
Oh, God, that's so great. So have you known writing it that at some point, maybe since you are a writer, it would be published? Like, did you have a sort of publishing vibe about it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, no more than anybody has, like, those grandiose feelings, like, maybe one day after I'm dead.
But you are actually a writer.
Yeah, but I never thought, I just didn't think that they were interesting, because mm-hmm. they were, like, working out problems. Mm-hmm. Like, Sarah Manguso, who's a writer who lives in this city, I think, like, I've read some of her diaries, and her diaries are really interesting, and they're kind of, like, reports of each day and what the people she met said, and there's scenes, and there's life to it, but this was mostly just working through problems, and, yeah.
There's a lot of life, though. Jack is having a big life.
Yes. That Jack was a strange chapter.
A really big
to
life.
Read. Yeah.
So how, like, what was the process then of deciding, I think I am going to do something with the diary?
So in 2010, I just finished this book, How Should a Person Be? And I'd been working on it for like 5 or 6 years. And I felt very nowhere after it was published. Like, you know, if you have this project you've been working on for so long and then you stop and it's done, then what? Like, what are you supposed to do with your days? What are you supposed to do with your mind? And I don't remember how I started thinking about it, but I realized, oh, I have all this writing, you know, the diaries I had like, probably 300,000 or 400,000 words or more, and I really like editing, and I like organizing, and I like cleaning things up, and I like tidying, and I like spreadsheets, and I think like my parents, my dad was an engineer, and my father, my dad and my father, and my mother is a doctor, and they have very analytical scientific minds, and I think I was just like, maybe I can apply this like analytical, scientific, rational process to the last 5 years of my life and look at them and look at all this material and just start playing with it. So it was like a desire to work, and it was also a desire to sort of analyze the time that had just gone by when I was writing that book.
That's so interesting, because the way you're talking about your approach to it is so like hyper-logical, spreadsheety. And if you think of a diary, it's like the opposite of a spreadsheet. It's like what's more emotional than a diary, even though, you know, the quality of your prose, it's not necessarily hyper-emotional, even when you are mm-hmm. feeling a lot of emotion, there's a way that it feels very detached when you're talking about it. Did you clean it up in that way, or what was the cleanup process like?
It was cutting. So I put all the diaries into Excel and, like, alphabetized them. Like, it has an A to Z function. And then, yeah, for the last 14 years, I guess, since 2010, I've been mostly cutting and rearranging in the sense of, like, not really knowing what I wanted it to be at the end. So for a while, I thought, like, maybe this should be a project. I should put all these diary entries on the web, you know, and like it should be an internet project. Or I was like, maybe it's an article length project. So it was just like not knowing how big or short it should be, not knowing like to what degree it should be an experiment? Like, this is proof of an experiment, or is it art? Is it something I'm trying to make interesting and beautiful? Or am I trying to make it boring and like let it be boring and let it be kind of endless and impossible to read? And so I think the last, yeah, decade and a half was just like vacillating and trying to find like where the needle ended up between experiment and like an enjoyable art piece to take in, you know?
You mentioned Sarah Manguso, and I'm wondering, do you like reading other people's diaries? Are there diaries that that you love?
I mean, I would love to read my friends' diaries. I don't think that I'm like such a big, I mean, I read Anais Nin's diaries, obviously, when I was a teenager.
Obviously.
And yeah. I don't think either of us would be up here. We had,
no,
I mean,
I would have
so
no
important.
Life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A million
we
percent.
Both had to like take water then, just like thinking about Anais Nin's diaries.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember reading hers, and I remember reading Bertolt Brecht's diaries, and those being big for me. I can't remember why his. But yeah, like when Sarah showed me, so Sarah wrote this book called Ongoingness, mm-hmm. which was a very thin book, and it's about how she's not going to publish her diary, and that when she had a child, she stopped needing to write a diary because the child became the marker of time, that she didn't need the diary to mark time. And I was really against that book. I was like, just publish the diaries. Like,
you want to know.
Yeah, and she showed me, she sent me some of her diaries, and they were incredible. And I really think, like, after she dies, not that I want her to die anytime soon, but I was like, I think that's going to be this incredible work. But I don't think I read, like, writers' diaries anymore. But I'd like to read all her diaries. Yeah.
Well, now I want to read them too.
You should ask her.
She's just sending Sarah Manguso. Little do we know, just sending her diaries out. If you ask her, you know, one thing that struck me when I was reading it is you're very sensitive and thoughtful to what were my notes to the way that you're perceived or misperceived, and you wrestle with so much in it, and yet you never seem to wrestle with this critique of the act of doing this kind of writing, you know, all the critiques about being self-obsessed or, you know, like narcissistic and all of these things. And I'm wondering, like, how do you navigate that sort of like lingering cultural cloud about this kind of work? Because I didn't see any of it in there. And you're such a philosophical person. I'm like, you must have a philosophy about it. It's your hidden philosophy.
I just don't believe it at all. Like, I don't believe that it's narcissistic. Mm-hmm. Or if it is narcissistic, I don't think that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's narcissistic. Like, I think narcissism hurts other people. And I don't think thinking about your life in the form of a novel hurts other people. Mm-hmm. So it just seems like a way of, it just doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Agreed. Agreed. Do you feel like you are a philosopher? And do you read?
No.
No, do you read philosophy?
I did a lot when I was younger.
Yeah.
No, I think I'm a novelist. Like, I think a philosopher to me is somebody who thinks they're a philosopher, for one thing.
You could become a philosopher right here, right now.
Though. Yeah, I could just make that decision. I like characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's Kierkegaard, right, who, like, wrote philosophy through characters, and he's, like, a huge influence on me, but I would never think that my thoughts are the interesting thing. I think the character who's expressing those thoughts are the interesting thing, mm-hmm. and the thoughts are interesting because they create a character. Yeah.
Okay. I found your book very philosophical. It made me also think a lot of Jenny Holzer's truisms.
Right. Oh,
right.
That's nice.
Yeah. Do you like her work and stuff?
Yeah, I love her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like there are lines that could be on t-shirts.
Yeah.
That are in this book. Let me see, what else do I? So you spent so much time with your own life in that way. Were you surprised by anything? Did you come to any kind of overarching conclusions or any kind of like, did anything become resolved in the process of kind of dealing with your life in this form?
Well, by the end, it was like 10 years of diaries that I was mm-hmm. looking at, because I kept adding, like at the end of 2011, I would like add the diaries from 2011 and then same 12, 13, and then I stopped. And I think I have more, I think what's changed about me since doing this project is I don't have a lust to change. Like, I think before that, I was so preoccupied with wanting to be a different kind of human than I was, and wanting to be multiple people, and wanting to be everybody, and wanting to have like every perspective and every mind. And when you go through 10 years of your diaries and you see how static you are, and how few preoccupations you actually have, and how repetitive you are, it just, that fantasy goes away. For one thing, because that fantasy is impossible to achieve, you realize. And for the other, because, like, I don't know, I just developed this kind of feeling of, like, it's okay. Like, it's okay just to be one person. It's okay to be also very narrow, you know? Like, other people are taking care of the other things in the world. Like, I can take care of this little narrow corner of existence. And it just seems like having, you know, like, those tiny homes. Like, to the self as this tiny home just seems really nice, like, actually to be so tiny. And I don't know, that's just how, I think that's what changed, if it, you know.
That seems kind of huge, actually.
Yeah, it is kind of. And I only have, like, only when you asked me that question did I realize it, because I think until you put out a book, like, when you put out the book, then the change happens. And so this book has only been out for a week. So I think it just happened this week.
That's so wild.
Yeah, I think that's, like, something that's changed in my, like, cellular, yeah, but just in the last month or whatever.
Wow, that's so cool. That's very interesting. Have you stopped smoking?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do you have any vices?
Vices?
Yeah.
Shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Shopping.
Shopping counts. Shopping's a vice.
Yeah, it is a vice. Yeah, it's a very good one.
Yeah, I mean, I like it as well.
It's ridiculous.
what else do I have here? I was wondering, like, I feel like you almost answered this in what you were talking about, like the conclusion, this sort of grand conclusion you came, that seemed like it was about acceptance. Like, I feel like so much of your work is about wondering if you should be a different kind of person. And I really relate to that. Like, there's just so many different kinds of persons a person can be. It's overwhelming, and it's so easy to be jealous of all the persons you're not. And I was wondering, reading it, if that kind of setting about seeking is a kind of person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I
like
think
it's
that's
not
right.
About the seek. It's not about the seeking. Like, I'm going to figure this out. It's like, no, that is, I am the person that is always wondering these things.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, and it's interesting. Like, it's interesting how that even relates to the relationships you have in your life. Like, you're also the person who has these certain kinds of relationships. And that's the other thing that I learned, writing this book or editing this book, is like, there's certain kinds of relationships that I have over and over again with people. And I always sort of thought that was them, sort of. And I realized, no, like, you kind of cast people in certain roles and you make people play certain roles. So, like, if you're a person who's, like, perpetually dissatisfied with your boyfriends.
For instance.
Well, I'm not thinking about myself because I've got other problems. I'm not, like, a perpetually dissatisfied person. But then you will always be perpetually dissatisfied, you know, like, with
right.
And it's interesting because I had to do something with the characters in the book. Like, I had to make composites because I didn't want people to be revealed to the world in the book. And it's amazing how easy it was and how natural it was to make new characters out of these sentences. Because there are only so many types of people in your life or in my life.
Uh-huh.
There's certain kind of women that I have in my life, like, with certain kinds of personality traits. And there's certain kind of men with certain kinds of personality traits. And then there's this whole sea of people with personality traits that I have not in my life at all. And so it was so easy to make up new characters from these sentences. I didn't change the sentences. I just changed the names, obviously. But, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Do you feel that?
I mean, I'm thinking that this is such an incredible project that, like, everybody should do it. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? As, like, a self-help, like, kind of, I don't know it, know thyself
weird.
Sort of project. Like, it's making me wonder about the, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right with, like, you set people up in roles and kind of interact against that role. And when you were talking about that and that you were seeing it happen again and again, it made me think, I heard that there's this, like, there, probably somebody out here knows it, that who came up with this. It's like the feminist hero's journey, where it's like not like vroom, and I got the golden fleece, but it's this sort of like it's like an upward spiral, right? You guys know what I'm talking about? You're too busy living it. It's fine.
Is that like an alarm?
Oh, all right.
What's an Amber Alert?
Is it? Oh, when you're Canadian.
But I think it may be. We have this in Canada too, where the police send something to your phone.
Yes.
If there's a kidnapped child, which is usually, I think, a divorce thing. It's usually a custody thing. Yeah.
These straight people need to get their shit together. Yeah. We're having an event. You don't need everyone's phones blowing up because there's some Kramer versus Kramer bullshit happening. Okay. Anyway, you're a Capricorn.
Yes.
I totally misread you as an Aquarius because you seemed so mystical when I heard you in conversation with Rachel Kushner. And so I wish I had taken notes. I just was sort of enjoying you guys talking. But had I known I'd be in conversation with you, I'd want to return. But do you feel like you're a mystical person, or do you have a mystical practice? Or I feel like, what's your sense of something beyond you? Do you have one?
Yeah, I think I don't use that word mystical.
Sure. It's goofy.
What?
We could use a better word for what we're talking about.
I mean, I think it's a very... it's weird. Like, to me, that feels like a narrow word, even though it's supposed to sound like such a big and grand word.
Yeah, but now we just think of head shops, and so we're like,
I feel like, I don't know if I'm like a spiritual person or anything like that, but I do feel like we don't really know anything. We don't know the important things at all. Mm-hmm. Like, all the things that I most want to know, I don't know and will never know, and no human knows. And that's weird. It's also like weird to be made into a creature who's never gonna know the important things. That's so stupid. Like, that all you know are the trivial things.
Yeah.
That's a very, and I'm like, why? Whose idea was this? And I don't think it was anybody's idea, but it's just a very strange state to be in and then die. And then who knows what that is?
Yeah.
You know?
Just more of the same. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows?
But I don't feel afraid of dying. Like, I think that after my father died, I don't feel afraid of it anymore. So I do have this feeling of, like, not that there's going to be answers after death, but that, I don't know, that there's just, like, actually nothing scary about not being.
That's really beautiful. Can I ask you what it was in your experience of observing your dad passing that released you from being afraid?
I just don't feel like he's gone.
Uh-huh.
And even now, I just don't really, like, in my body, I don't feel it.
Uh-huh.
And I think that maybe that has something to do with our relationship. I'm sure there are people who have lost people, and I'm sure I will lose people, and it won't feel like that. Mm-hmm. But this was the first most significant loss of my life. In the sense of somebody close to me dying, and that was my experience of it. And so therefore I have this feeling about death that is not quite real, mm-hmm. or that you don't totally disappear or something.
Yeah.
But I think maybe I'll have another experience and then my idea about it will change.
It was so huge and mysterious. It seems like hard to, I know, I hope you stay with that one. That one seems like the good place to be.
Yeah, it's hard to know why you have certain experiences of death or not. Like, I don't think people being bombed are having, like, these spiritual experiences of people being...
Of course not.
So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird to, like, have a good feeling about it after someone you love dies.
Yeah.
A good feeling about death.
Yeah. It seems like a gift, not to be Pinteresty.
Yeah, I think, like, it has to do with my father's character, because he was such a positive, optimistic person full of wonder. Mm-hmm. So maybe a person like that, when they die, they leave a good feeling behind of, like, something interesting is about to happen to me, you know?
Oh, I love that. What sign was your dad?
Hmm?
What astrological sign was your dad? Sorry, haters.
Libra.
Okay. That's lovely. Libra's a
lovely
sign.
But what does it tell you?
I mean, very little, obviously. But there is, just pairing what you just said about how there was, he was so optimistic. And, you know, like, Libra is a sign of harmony. And so there's people who have a prominent Libra tend to be people who enjoy bringing harmony to their surroundings. Okay. So I was like, oh, it just gave another flavor to the picture that you're painting about this person. Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, totally. So you've been on the road with this book for a few days. Mm-hmm. Do you like being on the road? Do you like traveling in this way?
I like being on stage, like talking about the book.
Yeah.
I like seeing my friends in different cities. I don't like leaving my laptop on the airplane, which I did today. I don't like...
She's being so chill about it. So chill about it.
Yeah, because all my stuff is like in the cloud. So I didn't lose anything except for the material. It's not one of a kind. It's expensive, but it's not one of a kind.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Do you have like special things you like to do while you're traveling? Do you have like a book with you? Do you read magazines? What are you reading right now?
I met this girl at my reading last night, and she was at the signing table, and I just had a feeling like, I bet she's a good writer. We were talking, and I just had a feeling, and I was like, what are you working on? And she said she was working on a novel. And I was like, can you send it to me? And so she sent it to me last night, and I've been reading it all day, and it's great.
Oh my God.
So I think I realized don't bring any, like, bring one book with you, but then, like, just let chance, you know, because you're in a different, you don't know what's going to happen. So, mm-hmm. And I like going to bookstores and getting books, because I was in a bookstore reading last night in San Francisco, so I bought a book there. And yeah, I don't think I want to know. I don't think there's any point in bringing books on tour, because you're in a different mind space than you were when you left.
That's really true. What bookstore did you read in last night?
The Booksmith.
Oh, on Haight Street.
Yeah.
That's a cool bookstore.
Yeah, they were lovely.
Do you feel obliged to like support the bookstores that are supporting you and buy books when you're there?
No.
Well, that's nice.
Well, because it's too heavy to, like, what are you going to do?
It's true.
But I did find one that I was excited by.
What is it?
I don't remember the name anymore. Okay. But I have it in my bag, and I just didn't look at it yet because I've had a busy day.
You sure have. You really have. She just got here today, you guys. Okay. We can also take questions from you. I'm sure you're all just brimming with curiosity after everything you've seen and heard up here. I believe if you raise your hand, yes, some wonderful library people will bring you your very own microphone.
I just had a follow-up question on something you just said about casting people in your life in certain roles. Can you give an example of one of those roles? And also maybe because you said there's certain roles for women and certain roles for men.
I mean, yeah. I mean, for me, I'm mostly into men. So like there's like the person that I have a crush on. Like there's always has to be a crush. Like it's very hard not to have one. Like and you get this feeling like it's the person. Like if I hadn't met this person, I wouldn't have a crush. Like I wish I hadn't met this person. But if there's always a crush, then it's like just not the, you know. It's like, well, this is the best case scenario for my crush right now. You know, this person. That's a really easy example. But like the friend who sort of like tells you what to do, who knows better than you, which is like everybody I put in my life. I mean, I really like people with very strong opinions who judge me. like Catherine, who yelled out shopping when you asked me what my vice was. Like, I really like know-it-alls because I feel like I need that strength to bounce off of to know who I am. Like, I need these people that, because I'm so watery or something, but if I have these strong personalities around me, then I can know things in response to their knowing things. I can be like, that doesn't sound right. But on my own, I won't come up with anything. So, yeah. That's an example. Oh, over there. This gentleman in the corner. Okay. Yes.
I was wondering if you take any inspiration from Toronto as a city.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, I've lived there my whole entire life, except for like tiny stints in Montreal, like for a year here and there, a summer in New York, and then otherwise Toronto. Toronto, at least when I was part of the scene in the 2000s, I guess, like 2000 to 2010, or that's when I felt like I was going out and being among people. It felt very collaborative and very, Margot always said this thing, Margot Williamson, who's a painter friend of mine, she always said, like, in Toronto, you can get people to, like, tear tickets at the door of your show and for no reason. So, like, I felt like everyone was kind of helping each other with their projects. And because there's not a lot of, like, it's not like in New York where you have people with, like, huge status around. So everyone can sort of be friends with everyone. Like, it just didn't feel competitive to me in some way. And everyone, it was kind of like a utopic place, really, for a long time for me. And I think the inspiration I took is I still like to have friends be part of my process. I like to make my work part of a community. Like, the way that I have friendships my work is part of my friendships. And I think that was a very Toronto thing. We all had, like, so much fun together, going to each other's shows and all that. And I still want that feeling, even though I don't want to go out to bars anymore. I'd rather, like, wear a sparkly jumpsuit at home and, like, send my book to my friends and hear their feedback. So, yeah, I just, like, I want my friends to be in my work with me. And I think that came from the fun that we had in those years. Yeah.
When did you know that it was real over and beyond the experience that you were having with your diaries? I feel so connected to your diary concept, and I just very curious as relative to, like, what was that process like when you were like, oh my God, okay, this is real, I'm published. Everyone's for me, I'm doing it right. And how did you navigate through that?
So you're asking what do you mean by when did I know it was real? Do you mean when did I know that it could be published, or when did I know that it was interesting, or what do you mean by real?
When did you know that you're publishing? I'm going to assume that because it was real to you in your diary, that it was real in your world. But when did you know that? Like, what happened to bring into place? Like, did you sit down and write the book? Did you hire a writer? Were you doing things like this? Did your friends come together and say, hey, this is what I, you know, received. You need to do something with this because tomorrow you'll do something else? Or what was that process like? When did it?
I mean, I think my boyfriend always called this my procrastination project. Like, I think it was just something I was doing alongside other projects. So it was like when I couldn't, so I wrote this book called Motherhood and Pure Color during the years that I was editing this. And it was always just, I can't work on those because it's too hard. Those projects are too hard. They're taking too much out of me emotionally. I'm going to go into this other document and play with these words. And I guess it was interesting to me for a really long time, but it wasn't interesting enough to publish. And then at a certain point, I gave it to this friend of mine, Leanne Shapton, because I thought maybe it needs illustrations. Like, there's some way it's not working. And she's a writer and an illustrator, and among a million other things. And she and her friend, Lisa Naftalin, put together this PDF for me of a few of the letters. And up until that point, like 2 years ago, the sentences had all been on their own line, sort of almost like point form. And what Lisa did was she put every sentence following the next, like in a paragraph, basically. And I think that's when it became real, because I was like, oh, now this looks like a novel. Like, this doesn't just look like a series of sentences. This doesn't look like, it didn't look, I don't know. It just, I'm like, oh, this is a story, you know? And I think that's when it became real. Yeah. Which was like 10 years after I started working on it. So it took a really long time for it to feel real. And in 2013, I actually had a publisher, Fitzcarraldo, who published it in the UK, say that they want to publish it. And I could have published it in 2013, but it just was like, it would have been so much longer. And it just wasn't good enough then. And I didn't know why. And I think why it wasn't good enough was because I hadn't yet given myself the permission to make it art. It was still science. And it wasn't a pleasure to read. And I had to let myself be like, no, it's art. You can edit it. You can change things. I didn't change the sentences, like the meaning of the sentences, but I made some of them better. I just like let myself make something nice rather than prove something. Yeah. Thank you. That was a good question.
Hi. So I guess I first want to say I'm a writer, and the first time that I don't want to cry, but like the first time that I started reading your books, I felt like someone finally got it. Like you communicate like the root of living and life in this very beautiful, simplistic, flawed human way where I'm like, yes, like this is, why is no one else saying this? Like, thank you. Like you make me feel real, to be honest. And like wow. What my thoughts are. And I guess I was trying to think of like, oh my God, I have to ask her a question. What am I gonna ask? And then I'm like, all I could think of was like, how did you get to be so brave? Like, how did you, how in like the literary world and the loudness of technology and attention spans of like how are you brave enough to like follow that like little spinning wild alive voice and making it just listening to it, I guess.
First of all, thank you so much for what you said. That makes me so happy to hear that. Like that the book should make you feel like alive and more human. I guess like there's lots of different answers to that question, but I think, honestly, like there's certain friends that just tell you like, you're a genius. This is incredible. No, don't do that, do this. Like, no, that's not good enough. Like that's, you know, you're being lazy. Like I don't think there's like this solitary bravery. I think there's like the support of really critical, loving people that see you, and that's it. Like, I don't think I could have done this if Margo wasn't like, no, that thing that you're saying is not dumb, it's brilliant, you know? Because we all, and I was like, no, but I don't remember anything, you know? So I think that's the answer, like, because you don't know yourself. You think a person doesn't feel very good about themselves. Yeah.
Hi. I had a question about your autofiction work, and I'm a writer too, and I always struggle with which parts to make the fictions and which parts to make the real. Like, where do you draw a line? Do you know, like, oh, I'm for sure gonna cut this because it's too close, or what's kind of the way you differentiate between the two?
I don't really experience any difference between what I imagine life to be and what life is. So, like, to me, it's all, I'm just so aware that I'm making it all up. And so then when I come to write, it's not like, well, this is real and this is imaginary. Because like even when I'm writing what's real, I'm like, well, this is clearly imaginary. Because I'm writing about my thoughts and like my feelings about the world, and that's imaginary. So there's no real.
This is the Aquarian shit I was talking about. Right? If you know, you know.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So it's not like, oh, here's the real stuff. Like, I have no memory. Like, I have a really, really bad memory. So I'm not writing about things that I remember. I think, like, I try to write when I feel like writing, and then I bring all that stuff together, and then I take out the stuff that bores me to read. Like, if I don't like the way that it looks on the page, if I don't like reading it, I just cut it. And then there's other stuff where, no, I kind of like that. Like, that kind of gives me a bit of a thrill, and then I keep it.
And it's not like about what's real or what's not real. It's just, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Because you end up having to read that sentence like 100 times. So if you don't, yeah. Yeah. Mary Kondo. It's got to spark joy.
Oh, I think this person is.
Oh, great. I'm an Aquarius. I guess, you know, something sparked this sort of thought in my mind when you were talking about this sort of tiny house metaphor. And, you know, I didn't see you when you made a pass with Pure Color, but, you know, something about the play between the small and, you know, like that book seems to be about getting so small, mm-hmm. you know, so small. If I'm mm-hmm. recollecting it, that's how I'm recollecting it. And this too seems like it's this play with consciousness, or, you know, I'm sort of become embedded in your consciousness. And I don't know if there's a question here exactly, but this play between tiny and big, and like
yeah.
How to grapple with the smallness and the.
I love smallness.
Yeah.
I like short, small books, and like yeah. I think I'm like a short, small person. So, like I think in some ways, like you're like you know when you see painters and you're like you look like your paintings or your paintings look like you. You know, and I think there's something about that with art, like there's some way in which I like short, small books because there's something familiar to me about them because I'm small. Like, there's a way in which you're just like, there's a way in which it's your body, you know? Like, you can't make, you're sort of making your body or something.
But your consciousness is huge.
Yeah, and so you can put like this huge consciousness in this tiny little shell of a tiny little book. Well, because your consciousness is huge because that's everything. And, but it's in the small little body. I feel sick when I think about cruise ships. I hate the hugeness of that.
I also hate cruise ships. I was curious about your process with your past self while you were writing this. Like, so much of this, mm-hmm. like, concept for a book is you're like, kind of in conversation with yourself, these different iterations of yourself split up across time and across circumstances. Did you feel like, what were the emotions that you felt about that version of yourself? Did you feel, like, frustrated at times, or, like, what was your process with that?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a friend pointed this out to me, who was giving me a tarot reading before I came on this tour, Becky Johnson, a Toronto comic, and she was like, it's your older self looking at your younger self, like your older self is edited, like the words were written by my younger self in my 20s and early 30s, and myself in my 40, like 30s and 40s is editing it, and I think that's why the book is funny, in part, because you see how funny you are, like, when you're 10 years away from that self. Like, you see the ridiculousness of it much. It's so clear, because you know what happened, you know? And you know, like, all this emotion went into this, you know, thing that turned out to be nothing or whatever. So, I don't know, I kind of like that interplay of, like, the older self editing and looking at the younger self and recontextualizing it. I forgot what your question was.
That kind of answers it.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about your relationship to your younger self, like, while writing it. And it sounds like maybe there are elements of, like, forgiveness, too, or, like, allowing yourself to just kind of exist as that self and not be critical.
Well, I also didn't read the diaries narratively. Like, they were alphabetized from the very beginning. So it's not like going into scenes and being embarrassed. It's just sentences. And like, there were some embarrassing sentences, but there's not like a sense of, oh, I'm looking through this logic and I'm progressing through this scene and like how embarrassing I was. which would have happened if I had to read through them. Yeah. Oh, there's somebody there.
Hi there. I'm deeply influenced by organized chaos, like taking material and randomizing it or forcing organization onto it and discovering these new connections that never would have existed if you don't like shuffle them out. With work that's this personal, I'm wondering if you have any examples of connections that you find deeply interesting that only you will ever get, things that are personal to you that none of us are gonna understand, but are a little twinkle that you would have not come across had you not done the project in this way.
I'm just gonna look, because nothing's coming to mind. I think it's like, I don't think there's anything like in the book that is just that I get that somebody else wouldn't get. Like, I don't think there's like secret parts of it just for me. I don't know, I have to think about that. That's an interesting question. You know, when you're like trying to make something beautiful, you're trying to make, I don't know, it's like, there's no like part of it that I'm like, if this is beautiful for me, then I'm not gonna make it apparent to other people. Like everything that I would have found beautiful about it, I would have wanted to make it apparently beautiful for the reader. So I don't think there is anything that I can think of, but I'll probably like wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh, that would have been the perfect answer. But I don't think so. Yeah.
I was interested how you were talking about the, like with the diary and keeping time, and then your friend, was it the Sylvia lady that said she didn't need a diary anymore because now she had a child?
Sarah. Sarah Manguso.
but like that, this is, and then you guys were both talking about like Anais Nin's diaries, and like, I'm just wondering, it seems like is that of a particular concern to you to like mark time, like, and have it like organized, I guess?
I mean, so I've got a really bad memory, and like I think that there's an impulse when you realize that about yourself to like write things down, mm-hmm. and keep them and save them because you're gonna never remember them otherwise.
Yeah.
And I think that's like what writing books is for me, actually. So it's like, books represent, like the book Motherhood like represents this like period of my life that I was thinking about certain things and I was having certain experiences. So I think what I've come to is like, no, you don't need to remember like incidents and anecdotes and whatever. It would be nice to, but maybe what I really more want to remember and why, part of the reason why I think I write novels is like, because I actually don't want my feeling about life and these phases of life that I experienced to just disappear. So I think for me, like documenting becomes making a project over like 4 or 5 years. And then that time is documented in a certain way, but it's not documented literally. It's just like a document of like where my being was like in time and space and stuff. And I do think there is that, because there is something scary about not having that anchor of your past, you know? And like when I read my first book, like the middle stories, when I read it now, I'm like, I really get the feeling of what it was like to be in my early 20s and going to university and feeling so alone and so lonely. And I'm not afraid of death, but like I also don't want to disappear, you know? And I don't want to disappear totally to myself. So it's nice to have those. But I think, yeah. I think sometimes like having a memory, maybe you don't need to write things down as much.
That's what I was wondering, because I've always had this sort of like crazy accurate memory, and I've always resisted diary writing.
You don't need one.
And then so I was just wondering, about the interest in, that marking.
Yeah,
time.
I think you don't need one, because your diary's in your head.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. You're welcome. Well, thanks for everybody for being here tonight. I appreciate you coming up. Thanks so much for your amazing questions.
Thank you for writing such a great diary and sharing it with everybody.
Thank you. Thanks for this wonderful conversation. Thank you for all your terrific questions. And Sheila and Michelle will be signing their books in the lobby, so please buy one. And thank you. And come next week on Tuesday for our first review, Women Writing About Rage. Rage, she wrote. But thank you all for being here. Take care.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by Hearst Foundations, Golden Globes Foundation, LA County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox Schiff, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, Estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library. To support programs like these, become a member at lfla.org.